Hi, this is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Stories of the Supernatural. Wherever you find us, whether it's a video or podcast on your favorite platform, please like and subscribe to us so that you can get notification of when a new show is released. You can also find us on major social media platforms. If you go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com, you can find links to the videos or MP3 files, which you can download and enjoy without commercial interruptions. If you're into classic horror, ghost, and adventure stories, I narrate Nightshade Diary, and you can find links at nightshadediary.com. If scary stories are your bag, and listening to encounters with cryptids, ghosts, dogmen, and other weird creatures sends a shiver up your spine, then go to supernaturalstorytime.com for links to our weekly podcasts. Noteworthy news about the paranormal world, true crime, conspiracy stories, and anything that is just plain weird can be found at eerie.news or visit the Stranger Than Fiction Stories tab at miamighostchronicles.com. Please subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. Just go to mppelliser.com for a link. I want to thank you for being part of my audience, and I think you are all wonderful. Hi, how's everybody doing? Well, this week I decided that instead of a guest, I'm going to be revisiting the series, What Happened to These Cold Cases. And lately, I'm sure many of you have seen where these cold cases are solved, sometimes many years later, with DNA, advanced DNA. And of course, if they're lucky enough to have kept any of the evidence, especially because some of these very old cases, sometimes evidence boxes were thrown away, or they were damaged somehow, and even if they wanted to, they're not able to do that tie-in. And in some cases, even the perpetrators and even the family members of the victims have passed away, but at least there's always sometimes somebody left behind that, I want to use that too often used word of closure, or some type of justification, maybe in the minds as to when they're left with a question, why was this person picked? Why did they do this to this person or persons? And sometimes, not all the times, but sometimes they do get an answer. So we're going to start off our first case. This is, at the time, this was a very famous case in California, which was tied into, how can I say it? It was several killings that were considered one time what was called the Hillside Strangler. And what they did at one point was almost any murder that was committed in that area and in kind of look-alike circumstances were lumped in here. But we're going to go into one particular murder by the girl named Kathleen Robinson. And you have to ask yourself, what is a perfect opportunity for a killer than to find another murderer to blame for their deeds? And I want you to stop and think about this, because sometimes we might see this on a television ad, and you know what? Sometimes you might think, well, who would be that devious? Yes, there are people or murderers that are devious enough to wait till the perfect opportunity presents itself, as in somebody that's committing very horrible murders and the police are looking at them really, really hard because they have a certain methodology, and it presents almost like a perfect chance for someone to commit a murder and say, I don't have to worry about it because they're looking only for this one perpetrator. And this is more or less what happened with this murder. Kathleen Kimberly Robinson wasn't identified until November 26, 1977. The 17-year-old had been found in a parking lot not far from a brushy area of the Wilshire District near the corner of Pickford Street and Curzon Avenue. She'd been strangled but not sexually molested. She was identified through a missing persons report filed by her mother, Ruth Vaughn. The mother and daughter lived at 2836 East Pico Boulevard. Kathleen Robinson was last seen the day before her body was discovered on November 17th. She had told her mother she was going to church. Prior to her murder, 10 young women were killed and dumped along California roadside since October 16. 6 bodies have been found in a 5-mile radius of Glendale. Despite the proximity of place and time, police believe that the cases were not connected. She was fully clothed, while 6 of the victims were nude. Now, eventually, she would be, though, included as part of the victims belonging to the Hillside Strangler. The police had organized what was called the Hillside Strangler Task Force, even though they believed that this was not the only one person committing the murders. They were concentrating on Hollywood Boulevard, since many of the victims were involved in the street scene, but not all of them, which included Kathleen Robinson. Her body was the only one outside of a hilly area. However, she was known to hitchhike, and her body was discovered a short distance from the Santa Monica Freeway in one of its major off-ramps, Fairfax Avenue. So they're very undecided what to do with her, because she was in that area, but and she wasn't what they call the street scene, but again, she was hitchhiking. So you see where they have their doubts, but they still include her as part of that group of victims. 20 months after the first strangler victim was discovered, Kenneth Bianchi was charged in 5 of the 13 murders. Now, Bianchi, or Bianchi, however you want to pronounce it, was arrested in Bellingham, Washington, after he killed co-eds Karen Mandick and Diane Wilder in January of 1979. Contrary to Los Angeles, he was now operating in the jurisdiction of a department run by Police Chief Mangan, a former Catholic priest in the Order of Oratorians, who later in life got into law enforcement. He had been ordained in 1964 and joined the local police department in Seaside, California, as a reserve officer in 1966. But he ran into a problem because as a cleric, he couldn't carry a gun. He ended up becoming a cop instead of a priest. Despite having a smaller force than the LAPD, he was able to break the case that eluded authorities for over 2 years. He died in 2014. The reason why this is mentioned is this task force was put together for 2 years. And from what I understand, they spent a lot of money, in the millions, between paying officers overtime, just staff to run this task force. And in the end, it was in reality broken by a small town police chief. Now in Washington State, Bianchi was sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms. He implicated his cousin, Angela Buono, with the murders in California. Buono was charged in 10 of the 13 murders attributed to the Hillside Strangler. And if you go back on the case, which I'm not going to go into, they kind of pointed the fingers at each other as to who was the one that led the other one, as they say, into doing what they did. And somewhere in the middle, the truth lies as far as that we're both definitely psychopaths. Now, after Bianchi tried to blame a co-worker named Gregory Flockoy for the deaths of the women in Bellingham. However, Flockoy had been killed in a motorcycle accident in May of 1979. But nevertheless, police ruled him out. It was definitive that Kathleen Robinson was not included in the list of Hillside Strangler victims. During the trial of Bianchi and Buono, George Samshak was serving time in a Massachusetts prison for armed robbery. He told authorities he had committed the murders of Robinson and Brakeholm with an accomplice named Peter M. Jones. Now, Brakeholm was one of the other girls that was killed, and she was a known prostitute. She had come from out east, and for some reason, he said that he had committed these 2 murders. Now, along with this accomplice named Peter Jones. Now, Jones was a maintenance engineer working in Beverly Hills who was arrested on suspicion of murder. However, he was never charged since police couldn't provide evidence to support the charge. And Samshak was never charged either. However, there was so much notoriety attached to the cases that even though Jones had been exonerated, he was fired and ended up moving to Maine to escape the adverse publicity. Even there, he faced death threats and someone shooting at his apartment window. When he contacted the LA Police Department, he was told the cases of Brakeholm and Robinson were unsolved and the records of both cases were, quote, destroyed in an earthquake, end quote. Jones offered a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the killer or killers, but no one came forward. Then in 2010, Ronnie Alcala, real name Raul Alcala Bucor, was sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison for the murder of Jill Brakeholm, three other women and a 12-year-old girl dating back to the 1970s. Police estimate he may have killed up to 130 people across the country. After pleading guilty in 2013 to two homicides in New York, he received an additional 25 years to life. Now again, you may ask yourself, why did Sam Schack go ahead and say he was the one that had committed the murders and even implicated somebody else? That answer is unknown. Now, what was one of the methods that Alcala had, or well before they knew who he was, that he would take earrings as trophies from some of his victims. He posed some of the dead women. One was raped with a claw hammer, and all were strangled and resuscitated to prolong their agony. He was dubbed the Dating Game Killer because in 1978 he appeared on the Dating Game. He was described on the show as a successful photographer, and the bachelorette Cheryl Bradshaw chose him but later refused to go on the date with him because she thought he was creepy. In 2016, DNA evidence connected him to the 1977 death of a 28-year-old woman whose remains were found in southwest Wyoming. She was 6 months pregnant. Her name was Chris Thornton, and she was found in 1982, 5 years after she disappeared. A herder came across human bones, which proved it was a woman with an unborn child. The case went cold until a DNA match was made in 2015. By then, Alcala's attorney said he was too ill to face trial. Alcala died in July 2021, awaiting execution. He was 77 years old. The murder of Kathleen Robinson remains unsolved, despite the 2 years the LAPD had a task force set up to find out who was murdering women around Los Angeles. Perhaps they were so set in looking for a certain suspect, they overlooked clues that were particular to one murderer, who cleverly took advantage of the situation and knew all he had to do was to make his crime just a little similar and it would be lumped into the handiwork of one person. Which is exactly what happened in this case with the murders. Because sometimes some of these cases are solved, or the perpetrator, and even though that person is not charged with them, they already know that he was there. It depends on the circumstances available to each case. But nothing has ever come of this with Kathleen, besides the fact that there were certain circumstances that were totally different. No one, deathbed confession, plea deal, none of that, nothing has ever come of any of those things that usually will produce some type of like last minute, you know, answer as to, yeah, it was me, or I know who did it, or anything like that. Nothing at all. So let's go on to the next case. And this is basically a set of cases, and they involved, unfortunately, children. All right. Most of them, again, out in the area of California. And let's go back to that same time period. A little bit later, we're talking starting in 1981. I'm sorry, 1980. All right. Now, from 1980 to 1991, several children were kidnapped and killed. Some were solved after many years, and some remained open and unsolved. And again, some of these have been like plea deals, other times has been last minute confessions, or even just cellmates. And also, of course, is the DNA tie-in. Now, the first child to disappear was Susie Bombardier, 14-year-old honor student who was kidnapped, raped, and stabbed to death on June 22, 1980. 5 days after her disappearance, she was found floating in the San Joaquin River east of Antioch, California, by a fisherman. This was about 100 miles from where she lived. The girl was taken from her sister's home while babysitting, leading her family to believe she knew her abductor. The case languished and at one point was considered Antioch's oldest cold case. It wasn't until 2015 that DNA samples from the victim were sent to a lab in order to make a profile. In 2017, the police were notified of a hit, and it was identified as a match to Mitchell Lynn Bacom, a California native with an extensive criminal history. In 1973, he was arrested in Mountain View, California, and convicted for second-degree burglary, sodomy, and assault with intent to murder. He got 5 years to life. By the time 1980 rolled around, he was out on the streets again, which is when he preyed on Susie. In 1981, he was arrested in Sacramento County and convicted of first-degree burglary, robbery, rape, and sodomy, and was sentenced to 24 years in prison. In 2002, he was out again and failed to register as a sex offender with Contra Costa County and sentenced to 4 additional years in prison. Even though he had been a suspect in the Bombardier case, it wasn't until March 2022 that he was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole through a DNA match. At the sentencing, prosecutors said that Bacom had admitted to cellmates he had raped and sliced prostitutes across the country when he was a truck driver. Bacom and Bombardier's sister had dated in the past. 3 years later, Antioch was rocked again by the kidnapping and murder of another girl. She was Angela Bouguet, who vanished on November 19, 1983, from Antioch. She was found a week later. She had been strangled and sexually assaulted. Police suspected Larry Christopher Graham, a commercial pilot, who lived in the same apartment complex as her family and had a history of sexual offenses against children. Graham had once been a lover to Susan Bouguet, Angela's mother. A few weeks after Angela was killed, Graham asked Susan Bouguet to marry him, and she turned him down. It wasn't until 1996 that Graham was arrested for the crime. The case against him was built using DNA testing, using semen taken from Angela's body. In 2003, after being found guilty, he was sentenced to death. In 2009, while on death row at San Quentin State Prison, he was found unresponsive and pronounced dead less than an hour later. It was suspected it was a suicide. He was 58 years old. Ironically, during the time Graham was on trial, his son, Larry Christopher Graham Jr., was being tried for the murder of Anthony Frank Buccolato, 57, who he pushed off a speeding truck into Highway 4 traffic in 2001. Charged as an accomplice, he testified in his trial that he had beaten Buccolato and decided to take him to the hospital when he realized the man was dead, so he pushed him out of the truck instead. Graham claimed the incident that led up to the skirmish with Buccolato was not a botched robbery, but that he was punishing him for making sexual advances at a teenage girl. The girl in question testified that it was indeed a robbery attempt. Graham Jr. was convicted of first-degree murder and robbery and sentenced in June 2003 to 26 years, 8 months to life in prison. But returning to the 1980s, when the Bouguet case was 5 years old and unsolved, another child went missing. On June 3, 1988, Amber Schwartz, 7, was taken a few miles from Antioch, California. Within days of the little girl's disappearance, a stranger named Timothy Binder introduced himself to the Schwartz family and said he was searching for the girl as well, but also told them they should be looking for a dead body. For years, he played a mouse-and-cat game with the family and police, claiming he was trying to find the girl, but at the same time foretelling the disappearance of other children. As you could tell, sometimes when you get crazy people in the mix, it just makes matters worse. On June 15, 1988, bloodhounds tracked Amber Scent to the grave of Angela Bugay. Police already knew that Tim Binder visited the cemetery to drink a beer while he leaned on Angela's tombstone. In 1989, Binder was detained by police in San Pablo, California, when he was seen sitting in a van talking to a group of kids. He was arrested on a misdemeanor charge of annoying and disturbing children after two 12-year-old girls complained that he kept offering them a ride. At his booking, they found a note in his wallet that read, quote, "I love you, Amber. You are my first, and I tried for you. Tried and cried and still ache in my heart. They will always try to pull me back, but I never will. They don't know about us. They never heard of us." End quote. In 2013, Amber Swart's case was reopened after it was closed in 2009 due to the confession of a murderer already serving prison time. His name was Curtis Dean Anderson. He confessed to a murder in 2007, a month before he died in prison from kidney and liver failure. However, police could not find any evidence to sustain this. Amber's mother did not believe his confession was truthful and that he just wanted to make a name for himself. He confessed on a brief handwritten statement that read, quote, "If there is no pursuit of the death penalty, I will freely admit my role in being responsible for the death of Amber Swartz Garcia." He said he was driving to Arizona and took the girl as company. He told investigators he kept the girl sedated by giving her root beer schnapps and killed her at a motel room in the Tucson area before disposing of her body in the desert. In 2019, Anderson's son, Curtis Dean Anderson Jr., was serving a 16-year voluntary manslaughter sentencing for killing 31-year-old Vance Fisher in 2005. He committed suicide. In other words, you have one perpetrator who has his junior son getting tried and convicted for being accomplice to murder. Now you have this guy, Curtis Dean Anderson, with his, again, is a junior who was already in jail for serving, well, for voluntary manslaughter, serving a 16-year sentence for killing a man by the name of Vance Fisher. He commits suicide. So it's like a ripple effect that goes just beyond the family and the victims. Even their own offspring suffer for it. It seems that Amber's mother was no stranger to tragedy. Amber's father, Floyd Bernie Swartz, a Pinole police officer, was killed while pursuing a parolee in 1980. His wife was pregnant with Amber then. The killer was James Odell, who died in December 2020 while serving his sentence. He died from natural causes at the age of 71. So this poor lady, she's pregnant. Her husband is killed by someone that her husband is trying to stop. She has a child, and then she loses that child, who's only 7 years old. That's very, very tragic. Now, fast forward now, we're going back to in the middle of all of these cases, Timothy Binder is still going round and round. He's a very weird and unusual character. This is 1995, and he's been discounted as a suspect in the Bugay murders with the arrest of Graham. However, there's still four unsolved kidnappings. All right? One of them was Michaela Joy Garrett, age 9, who disappeared on November 20th, 1988, on a trip to the grocery store. Her body has never been found. In 2020, David Mish, who was convicted in 1990 of the 1989 stabbing murder of a 36-year-old Margaret Ball, was charged with murdering Michaela due to his prints being found on her scooter. He is also suspected of killing two women in Fremont in 1986. Eventually, he would be charged with their murders. The women were best friends, Michelle Xavier, 18, and Jennifer Dewey, 20. In March of 2023, Mish was ordered to stand trial for all three crimes. However, the judge said he believed that when it came to the death of Xavier and Dewey, Mish didn't act alone. His proceedings are ongoing at this time. Let's go back to the 80s. It's January 20th of 1989, and Eileen Mishaloff, age 13, disappeared from Dublin, a halfway point between Hayward and Antioch, California. Eileen was taking a shortcut home, going through a wide alley behind a shopping center. After a search was conducted for her, her backpack was found in the creek bed in John Mape Park. Irene's remains, like Amber, have never been found. Present-day police are offering a $95,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for Eileen's death. Investigating agencies are re-examining the case after David Mish, 59, was charged with the murder of 9-year-old Michaela Garrett. On December 27, 1991, Amanda Nikki Campbell, age 4, vanished close to her Fairfield, California home. She was riding her bike to a friend's house only 8 doors away from home. Her bike was found, but the child was never seen again. In 1992, Tim Binder was named the prime suspect. As a former crematorium worker, he would visit the graves of young children, taunting the suffering parents, and would give neighborhood girls cash gifts, cards, and poems. He would ultimately be tied to 5 cases, yet police were never able to link him to any of them. He said he was just a good Samaritan and won a suit against the city for defamation of character and was awarded $90,000. The case of Amanda Campbell is still cold. What happened with J.C. Duggard justifies the hopes that parents have when the bodies of their children are not found. One of them was J.C. Lee Duggard, age 11, who was taken on June 10, 1991, when she walked home from a school bus stop in Myers, California. In 2009, convicted sex offender Philip Garrido visited the campus of University of California, Berkeley, with 2 adolescent girls. Due to their suspicious behavior, police interviewed them. It turned out the girls were daughters he had with Duggard. Garrido and his wife Nancy were arrested in April 2011. They pled guilty to kidnapping and raping Duggard. They had kept J.C. prisoner for almost 20 years. Garrido was sentenced to 431 years and his wife Nancy to 36 years to life. In 2010, the state of California awarded the Duggard family $20 million since Garrido had been on parole for a 1976 rape when she was kidnapped. He had not been monitored as should be while the state was supervising him. In 2002, police were searching the home of Stephen Kisley, a defrocked priest in connection to the Swartz case. However, there was nothing to connect him to the murder. They were also looking for evidence connected to several cases of kidnapped children. One of them was J.C. Duggard, who had yet to be freed from a horrible existence. The search warrant was also related to another missing child. His name was Tony Franco, age 10, who was last seen walking along Fremont Way in Lemon Valley and reported as leaning over and talking with an unknown subject in a rusted out, possibly Ford Pinto or even a Camaro car. He was on his way to school on May 9, 1983 when he vanished. 4 years after Tony Franco disappeared, another girl disappeared. At 3 p.m. on Sunday, June 28, 1987, 11-year-old Jennifer Lee Martin purchased candy and a 6-pack of Coca-Cola at a 7-Eleven convenience store on Lemon Drive. By the way, this is in Reno. This is not in California. We're in Nevada now, right? So she's seen walking out of the store, headed toward a nearby home, and she was last seen a short distance from where Tony was kidnapped. Authorities had good reason to suspect Stephen Kisley. He had already been charged with cases of molesting children in his Alameda County parish between 1969 and 1971. In 2004, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison for sexually assaulting a young girl a decade earlier at his vacation home. Kisley was released in 2009 and moved to Rossmore, California the following year. He had previously served 3 years probation after pleading no contest in 1978 to misdemeanor charges that he tied up and molested two boys. He was later charged with 13 counts of child molestation linked to allegations from the 1970s, but they weren't brought to trial because of the statute of limitation. They dug up his yard, but nothing was found. In April 2022, Kisley was charged in a fatal crash that killed a man. Kisley, now 75, was driving under the influence when he struck a couple on a sidewalk in the retirement community of Rossmore. Unfortunately, these cases are only a small sample of kidnappings and murders that took place within a 10-year span. Some of them were resolved, and in some cases with good police work or DNA technology, but not all. It's obvious that in those years, very dangerous pedophiles were on the streets, stalking prey, and who easier than a child? As of 2023, the cases of Amber Swartz, Eileen Mishaloff, Amanda Campbell, Tony Franco, and Jennifer Lee Martin are all cold cases. And what that tells us is that these, there's no way ever to be sure, because in some cases, as these cases get older and older, people die. If they can't even trace somebody to give them a DNA match or DNA sample so that they can keep it, they have nowhere to go with this either, as far as from either the scene, the murderer, or a family member. So, unfortunately, some of these are destined to remain cold again, unless someone at the last minute, deathbed confession, some of these killers, they're already doing maybe prison time for other types of murders. They come forward and they say, I was the one that did something. It was me. You know, at this point, they know that nothing's gonna happen to them, in other words. You know, they understand that they're not going to. As a matter of fact, you can even see in the case of Alcala, he was so, he was already about to die that they didn't even pursue, they didn't take him, they didn't go even bring him to trial. And that's one of the things that happens. Now, this is another child murder that occurred right around the same time. And this was in February of 1998. And human remains are unearthed near Bothell. This is outside of Seattle. And it appeared to be skeletal remains of two persons. The first set of bones was found by a transient who spotted a skull lying on top of straw that was scattered over a newly graded construction site. Before the month was out, they were identified as the remains of Sammy Joe White, age 11, and Carmen Joy Cubillas, 9. They were half-sisters. Been killed soon after they disappeared. The girls were living with their mother, Margaret Delaney, in the Crest Motel on Aurora Avenue North. The family was transient, never staying long in one place, at least not long enough for them to go to school. Sam White and Leonel Cubillas, fathers of the girls, had a hard time keeping track of their daughters, as their mother would move from one cheap motel to another. Besides the girls, there were 7 other siblings, all living together at the motel. The places they were staying at were in unsafe neighborhoods. Their last address was at the Crest Motel in room 16, then moved there the day before the girls vanished. They were last seen on Aurora Avenue, which was rife with drug dealing and prostitution. The girls had left the motel around 10:30 p.m. to beg for food at Taco Time restaurant down the street and to bum cigarettes for their 16-year-old brother. A family friend said both girls were like little mommies left to raise their younger siblings. When Margaret Delaney returned to the motel, the girls were gone, and she waited 3 hours before calling police. The police believed the girls had run away, even though their mother denied this. She told police the girls didn't have money, but they knew how to panhandle. For 7 years, the case lingered as unsolved, and in 2005, the case was being reexamined for a connection to Joseph Duncan, a convicted sex offender and murderer. On July 2, 2005, Joseph Edward Duncan III was arrested at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, at a Coeur d'Alene, Idaho diner after he was seen with a kidnapped victim named Shasta Groan, age 8. Duncan is later charged with killing Shasta's mother, brother, and her mother's boyfriend in their Idaho home on May 16, 2005. He's also accused of kidnapping Shasta and her brother Dylan, who was 9 at the time, and sexually abusing them for 7 weeks before killing Dylan. Later, he provided the FBI with details about the murder of the two girls, but didn't give a confession. He also talked about another youngster he killed in Southern California in 1997. In October of 2006, Duncan pled guilty to first-degree murder and kidnapping for 3 persons at their grown home. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. In January of 2007, Duncan pled guilty to the murder and torture of Anthony Martinez, 10, that occurred in 1997, and Sammy Joe and Carmen. In March of 2021, Joseph Edward Duncan, age 58, died at a hospital in Terre Haute, Indiana, while awaiting execution and serving multiple life sentences in federal prison. Even though the case of Sammy Joe and Carmen is considered solved, it was only done so because Duncan supposedly admitted to the murder, but he was never charged with their murder. The information about the murders came from Shasta Groan, who Duncan kidnapped. She said Duncan had told her he beat both girls to death, and even now, was he being truthful or just trying to scare her? In one of the videos shown to the jury during Duncan's trial, while he's torturing Dylan Rome, he says, screams, "The devil is here, boy, the devil himself. The devil likes to watch children suffer and cry." Which is pretty obscene, by the way, because this man was a monster. And again, like I said, well, he was not that old, but he died. And again, he never confessed to the murders of Sammy Joe and Carmen. And this information was obtained from Shasta. Was he being truthful? Was he, or maybe he heard it from somebody else and he just told her this to scare her? So even though it's considered solved, it's still a question mark. He didn't admit to it. Not really, didn't confess to it. So let's go on to the next story. And in this one, I decided to go back a little bit further back, quite a bit. And this involves a girl by the name of Amy Murphy. And the year is 1900. And even though, again, this you're going to see, even though this case seems like if it was solved, in reality, it's really a cold case. Now, Amy Murphy, 17, she's died mysteriously. Her body was found lying in the Golden Gate Park on February 2, 1900. It was in a partially shaded area down by Hay Street by the big eucalyptus tree that stood on the left just beyond the Peacock Walk. First, it was a suspicion she died by her own hand, but others thought it was murder. The revolver from which the bullet found in the girl's head had mysteriously disappeared, which made the theory of self-destruction questionable. Later, it turned out that she had pawned her watch in order to buy the firearm. So, first we have a missing revolver, and you'll see also why it's questionable if she did do that to herself. Once her body was identified, police rounded up Horace Poulon, who was supposedly the man Amy ended her life over. He was taken to the place where Amy committed the act and then to the McAvoy's undertaking parlor at 1235 Market Street. A certain Mr. Cook came forward to say he had been sitting on a bench in the park when he heard three shots ring out. Then he heard footsteps of someone running down the path toward him. Then three boys appeared, one of them with his hand under his coat, as if he was carrying something that he concealed there. They seemed to be no older than 14 years old. When the boys saw him, they stopped for a moment. Then they ran down one of the paths and out of sight. Were they a witness to the crime? Or perhaps did they take the revolver? The authorities never got an answer to that question. The mystery deepened when, during the autopsy, a large, irregular gash was found at the right side of Amy's head in front of her ear. Coroner Cole opined this was made by a blow with a blunt weapon of some sort, possibly the butt of a heavy pistol. There were no powder marks around it. A large caliber bullet was removed from the brain, and the question was, which had caused her death, the bullet or the blow? Amy's mother and younger sister came to the morgue to identify the remains. They described she had deceived her family, telling them she worked at night at a telephone office, when in reality she was keeping company with the wine agent named Horace Poulon. This had been going on for 8 months. However, once Poulon found out that she had been an inmate of the Magdalene Asylum, he cast her off. Or at least, this is the justification he gave. It turned out that Amy had been sent to the Magdalene Asylum 4 years before. Amy's father was Dan Murphy, a liquor dealer who lived in Seattle. Several years before, her parents had separated, and Mr. Murphy took the two oldest children, which were Amy and Harry, and the mother kept the two babies. Amy stayed with her father for a couple of years before returning to her mother in California, who in the meantime had married Captain John Creeling Dart of the steamer Sparrow. It's not clear if Amy was sent to the Magdalene Asylum by her father in Seattle or by her stepfather. However, there was a stigma attached to a girl who had been sent there, any girl that had been sent there. And the reason is, of course, that you weren't, let's put it this way, good girls weren't sent there. Troubled girls were. The Magdalene Asylum was founded in 1856 by the Sisters of Mercy as a refuge for prostitutes, but in 1868, it began taking in girls who were sentenced to the city's industrial school, which was a juvenile prison. Parents could ask the court to send their uncontrollable daughters to the asylum. A girl could end up there if the police charged her with vagrancy or for keeping company with gangsters or prostituting themselves. Many of them were orphans. Once a girl turned 18, she could leave if her parents or caregiver petitioned it. In some cases, some ran away. Soon after the turn of the 20th century, it was renamed to St. Catherine's Home for Wayward Girls. It was sold to the city in 1931, where it housed the mentally ill and was a maternity hospital. But it seemed Amy Murphy was a troubled girl, since according to her younger sister, Winnie Murphy, Amy had spoken of doing away with herself and even asked her brother the best way to do it. Her family did not believe she would go through with it. She was described as being content in her behavior and had gotten a job in a phonograph parlor on Kearney Street. When her mother learned she had not worked for months, she said the girl brought her money at the end of the month, claiming it was her salary. There were many times Amy would tell her mother she was sleeping over at her friend Nellie Peters' house when this was not true. Her mother was unaware that her daughter had spoken of taking her life. Only her younger sister knew of this. Winifred Murphy quoted her sister saying, quote, "If I don't get another position in a day or two, I will kill myself," end quote. However, her sister didn't believe she would actually carry out this plan. She insisted that someone had murdered her sister. Horace Poulon, who was the city agent of the Eisen Vineyard Company, was accused of luring a 17-year-old girl from her family with promises of luxurious living. He gave a formal statement to the chief of police that read thus, quote, "I was introduced to Amy C. Murphy about last July by Mrs. Toomey, a telephone operative who worked with this girl. About a week after I became acquainted with her, she told me how miserable she was at home. I took pity on her and told her that I would pay her what the telephone company was paying if she would come live with me. During our acquaintance in December, I learned that she had been an inmate of the Magdalen Asylum for 3 months, and I asked her if such were the fact, and she acknowledged it. So my attentions to her cooled, and she thought it was going to be the end of it. I told her, finally, in justice to myself, that our relations had to cease. She went home as usual in the morning, and Saturday afternoon sent for one of the boys in the office, a Mr. Mail from the Carrollton, Golden Gate Avenue, and Market Street. He called up there and found her in a distressed condition and pretty full, and saying that she was going to end it all. He came and repeated this matter to me. I went up there and found the gas partly turned on. I told her not to make a fool of herself, and took her to my house, put her to bed while I went to get her something to eat. I left both my gas jets off, and on my return found them both turned on, with the room full of gas. I was very much alarmed and sought my brother in the Orpheum, who was taking in the show, and he returned with me and spent the night with me in order to prevent her from repeating this. The next morning, Sunday, she was in a more rational frame of mind, and I left her to go home. Tuesday afternoon, she called at 114 Sutter Street, and I met her on the sidewalk. She asked me my opinion about her taking a position in a phonograph place on Kearney Street near California. I asked her the nature of the work, and she said it was attending to some phonograph machines that a young lady can operate. I looked at the place and advised that it was not of the first-class order, but to suit herself about taking the position. I told her if she was in need of any money that I would give it to her, that if she wanted to visit her old home in Eureka, that I would give her the money. I even suggested to her to go to visit her father, Dan Murphy, a saloon keeper in Seattle. I left her to go and attend to my business at the corner of Market and Grant Avenue. That is the last I saw of her. I asked her what her plans were. She told me to go and see her sister Winnie, and she would tell me her plans. End quote. Under further questioning by police, he said he had known Amy Murphy 1 week before he asked her to come live with him. He had taken her to a flat on Bush Street and then to other places, always posing as if they were married. When asked if he ever intended to marry her, he said, "Well, there was some talk about that between us." The police wanted to know if they had been living together as man and wife for so many months, why was he ready to discard her just because she had been an inmate at the Magdalen Asylum? His reply was, "Well, I had to send her away in justice to myself." He admitted he had tired of her. He described her daily routine, which was that she would stay at her mother's house until 8 p.m., then pass the early evenings as she pleased, and then around midnight, she would join him at the saloon at 114 Sutter Street, which was his headquarters. When police searched Poulin's flat at 821 Bush Street, they found a number of Amy's trinkets and a pair of slippers wrapped in newspapers and thrust in a closet. During the last time that Amy was with him, Poulin had told his landlady to keep an eye on her since she had twice attempted to kill herself. However, when the landlady arrived, she found all the windows were open. Was there a reason why Poulin wanted to make others believe that Amy was suicidal when she wasn't? Then police spoke to John Palinap, 27, who worked for Sherman Clay & Company, who sold musical supplies. He was living in Oakland for only a couple of months. He had moved to San Francisco 5 years before from Salem, Oregon. He said he had met Amy, but she used the name of Amy Dart. They had met about 18 months before, and he had at times called on her at her mother's house. Days before her death, she had sent him a letter to meet her in San Francisco. A few days later, however, she failed to meet him on the agreed-upon date. Palinap knew who Poulin was and had met him once at Amy's house, but he was unaware of the relationship he had with Amy. Amy's friend Nellie Peters, contrary to her family, did believe the girl did shoot herself over her failed romance with Poulin. Amy had told her that they were to be married and were only waiting for her to turn 18. Her birthday was in February, the very month she died. No doubt Poulin had cast her off since once she turned 18, Amy expected they would be married, and perhaps that had never been in his plans. Amy told Nellie that she was unhappy because of the harsh treatment she received at home, but her troubles went back to when her mother left her father, and she and her brother were left to the mercy of a father who was unkind. She ran away from her father and came seeking her mother, who she said was not affectionate towards her, and that she was wrapped up in the child of her second husband. She was made to feel she was not wanted in her mother's home. Her mother had one daughter named Geraldine with Captain Dart, who was 4 years old at the time of Amy's death. Amy said that Horace Poulon was the only person in the world who showed her any affection or was really kind to her. Then she confided that she would never marry Mr. Poulon, that he drank and she was afraid she would be unhappy with him. When Nellie urged her to go and tell her mother and to tell her all, she became frightened with this suggestion. Her friends suspected that she was not telling her the real reason why she couldn't be married to Poulon. Nellie then told her to go see her friends in Eureka and have nothing more to do with Poulon. However, Amy didn't take this advice. Ultimately, nothing came of the short investigation as to what truly happened to Amy Murphy. Some believed it was suicide. Others believed it was murder. A charge of adultery made against Horace Poulon by the police was dismissed by a judge. He was called a street leper by the newspapers of the area, and his reputation was tarnished, to say the least. Horace's troubles weren't over, though. In 1901, he was accused of embezzling $45 by a liquor merchant. Poulon had left for New York because of the scandal, but returned to San Francisco because of a new job offer. No doubt the sentiment of his involvement in Amy Murphy's death was still held against him. He settled the matter and dropped from sight. In 1920, Amy's father, Daniel Murphy, was found floating in Puget Sound. It's unknown if it was accidental or suicide. However, he was known to have, quote, suffered occasionally from melancholia, end quote, which of course was another word used for depression. His obituary only referred to a son, Harry Murphy, and a brother, William Murphy, as his surviving family. There was no sign of robbery, and he had a checkbook with an $11,000 balance. Harry Murphy, which was Amy's brother, became a well-known political cartoonist who was employed by various newspapers. He had started his career when he was only 17 years old and living in Washington. He passed away in 1973. John Planalp, the would-be suitor, who perhaps would have given Amy a happier destiny, died in 1927. So you can ask yourself, was it a suicide? Or was it a murder? Even though she talked about it, there seemed times almost that Poulon wanted to make it look like she was suicidal, and she wasn't. Her mother had no idea what was going on. She was living a double life. So where does the truth lie? And again, what happened to the revolver that was used to kill her? Or to inflict that wound? Also, that wound in front of that, she had a separate wound, like she had been knocked in the head. And also, there's the timing on this. Once she turned 18, which was in February, she would not need parental consent to get married, which leads one to believe that at that point she would be going to Horace and wanting to get married. So where does it lie? Again, even though it's been solved, because it was closed out as a suicide, I still believe that in many ways it is still some type of cold case. Now, I'll be coming back next week with a new guest, new interesting stories, so please don't forget to check out the YouTube videos. We're also on Rumble, Cloud Hub, Steam It. I'm all over the place. Also go and join my newsletter at MiamiGhostChronicles.com or MPPellister.com. You can find links there to everything. Videos, articles, and podcasts, whichever you like. So I'll be seeing you guys soon. Take care.